I think you know where we are here in James 4. We've been talking about the heart, the tongue, and gotten down to this real useful, real practical, real alive, if you will, just a live section of Scripture that has been meaningful to many people throughout their lives. Every Christian has access to the Word. This has got to be a meaningful passage to you. Even this week has been very meaningful to me. We're talking about God brings a solution for our heart's corruption, or we get it infiltrated with ungodly thoughts. We get it infiltrated with selfishness that is innate to our nature as humans, and our hearts just aren't where they should be before God. And God just comes down to us right here and says, "This is what you need to do." And we spent last Wednesday night talking about the very beginning place of that, or the reason that we have this solution, and it's because God gives more grace. We talked about grace Sunday morning, and what it is and what it means. God gives more grace. What a wonderful, wonderful truth. And even this week, this passage that I know so well, as far as being able to say the words, has been really sweet to me. I want to just share this little testimony with you. I've shared it with a couple of you already, but Sunday morning, I was really looking forward to preaching Sunday. Even on Saturday night, thought about the message and prepared and meditated on the message. And then Saturday night, just had the urge to kind of take a little bit different angle on the message. I won't tell you all about it, just to bring in some other thoughts that I hadn't thought about bringing in before. And just woke up Sunday and was excited about it. Got to the church early and was meditating and praying and just eager, if you will, to come up and stand up and preach to you about sovereign grace. And I got up in the pulpit and I just had the most dry, and I'm not looking for, please understand, I'm not looking for after church, "Well, that was good." I'm not looking for that, because I hope and I know where the Spirit works. The Spirit works where He will, how He will, when He will, through the use of a man or in spite of a man, okay? And I'm thankful for that. So if you were blessed, I praise the Lord Sunday morning. If you walked out of there saying, "I'm thankful for grace, and I want to embrace the grace of God, I don't want to take the grace of God in vain," I praise the Lord. Because to God be all the glory, okay? But here's how it was for me. It was as dry almost a routine, a struggle. It was just laborious for me to stand up here Sunday morning. And then walking out of the pulpit, of course, I was just bothered by that. Sister Patsy said, "Brother Isaac, you're sick." And I was like, "Oh, no, I'm fine. I just don't want to talk to anybody. I just want to get into this little shell and crawl into it." So then all Sunday evening, did a little exercise that evening. And then after that, I thought, "Well, I'll just be able to go to sleep and get in bed." Just tossed and turned for hours and hours and hours and thought, you know, what was that? How can you preach grace and not feel anything in your heart? And I wasn't having any evil, well, every thought that thinks God is evil, but I just walked out of here just unsettled. And it was bothersome to me. And the thought that started coming to my mind, and it was just a swoosh of relief, was this passage in James 4. I don't know exactly what went wrong, and part of what it may have been was just the fact that God knows how to humble us, which is important, right? We need humility, as we're going to see. And humility doesn't come natural to us. That may have been all it was. Or maybe there was something in my mind or in my heart or my life that wasn't right. I don't know. But the point of it is this is exactly the passage to go to in those kind of situations. Draw nigh to God. He'll draw nigh to you. Cleanse your hands. If there's something you're doing that's against God, cleanse your hands and purify your hearts and turn from your double mind. And so, we won't go through all this tonight, but let me just tell you, it's a great passage because it's a solution. God doesn't just set up this barrier between Him and His saved, redeemed people and say, "Slam him down. You've enough. We're done." He doesn't do that. Even to Laodicea, where he speaks those vicious words, kind of grotesque words, I will spew thee out of my mouth. He then says, behold, I stand at the door and knock. And if any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come into him and I will sup with him and he with me. And friends, that God gives more grace, okay? That's it. God gives more grace. I'm standing at the door knocking. Now we know that's not standing at the door of the dead sinner's heart and begging him to accept Christ, receive. That's not what it is at all. He's speaking to a church who's gotten lukewarm, whose hearts have been corrupted somehow, and they're not right. He says, listen, I want fellowship with you. And so I have this week, I'm not saying I'm on some spiritual high, but I have craved the fellowship of God. And he says he'll give it. And that's good, right? And so the very first thing that he says to us, I'm going to look at one thing tonight about dealing with a corrupted heart, is he says in verse 6, but he giveth more grace. Wherefore he saith, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble. And then he repeats it in verse 10. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he shall lift you up. So he repeats this thing about humility twice. Or he repeats it once, he says it twice. And he puts it at the very beginning of the steps of purifying, of cleansing our hearts. And certainly it is at the very beginning, and it's there for a very good reason. Humility is, many of the things that he says to do here in this passage are things that we do, okay? But humility is less something that we do and more just an attitude of the heart, okay? Humility is an attitude of the heart. To put it another way, humility is a change in perception about ourselves. Okay? It's a change in the way I look at myself. It's a change in the way I think about myself. And that's incredibly important, right? Because everything that corrupted our hearts in the earlier part of this passage was something to do with self. There was envy, there were selfish desires, there was a desire to be a friend with the world. There was this lack of prayer. Everything that corrupts our heart has to do with a wrong view of self, right? So the fix for that is to begin to look at self the right way. Now, humility is not a hard concept to understand, is it? But it's a hard attitude to have. It's a hard reality to have, isn't it not? And here's why. Because let me tell you what humility means in this passage. Humility means, actually, the word itself here actually could be said this way, to be humiliated. Okay? Now think about that. Who would choose to be humiliated? You think, well, that's maybe too strong. Maybe that Greek definition is off a little bit. Let me just tell you how the word is used in Scripture. It's the word humility or humble yourselves. But let me tell you a few of the other ways. I won't turn there because we don't have time. Let me tell you a few of the other ways this same Greek word is translated in our Bible, okay, in the New Testament. Cast down is the same word as humble yourselves. Lowly, base, and low degree. Now, none of those words sounds much more appetizing than to be humiliated, does it? Okay? Let me just turn to another passage real quick and just show you the difficulty of this grace. Romans 12. Romans 12. Verse 3. Now he just told us in verse 1 and 2 that we need to crucify self and present ourselves as a sacrifice to God. Our bodies sacrifice to God. And then he says we also need to change the way we think. Renew our minds. Transform the renewing of our minds. And then he says this in verse 3. He knows how hard that is to do. Why is that hard? Because we think too highly of ourselves. We don't see this need for humility or to change our minds or to change the way we think or to change what we're doing with our bodies. So he says in verse 3, for I say, through the grace given unto me to every man, so that nobody's accepted, to every man that is among you not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly according as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith. And so he says, listen, this is for everybody. Don't think of yourself more highly than you ought to think. Now that sounds good, right? We know it's true. But then it also sounds like this. It sounds like, I think it was raining earlier, it sounds like me sending Carson to the rain without an umbrella and saying, Carson, don't get wet. Okay? It's not going to happen, is it? There's no umbrella, it's pouring down rain, say, Carson, don't get wet. Why? Because it's just impossible. It's against nature. Nature says that when rain is falling upon somebody, you're going to get wet, right? That's nature. And our nature is to think of ourselves more highly than is appropriate. So just to tell somebody, stop thinking about yourself as highly as you think about yourself, way too highly, lower your perception of yourself. Humble yourself. Is ineffective, isn't it? You take a screaming child who's angry and you say, you're thinking too highly of yourself, Johnny. What's it going to do? Nothing, right? Or you take a person who's pursuing a desire that is obviously evil, yet their mind is keyed in on it. You say, you're thinking too highly of yourself. Humble yourself. It's going to be like water off a duck's back, right? So there's a missing ingredient here, and James fills in the ingredient. Not that it's missing from the Scripture. It's a missing in our understanding, okay? And James fills in the ingredient. It's so important. And here's the truth. The truth is this. Our perception of ourselves, or the way we look at ourselves, is never going to change unless our perception of God changes. Unless the way we view God changes, the way we view ourselves is never going to change. Okay? What's the problem with the way we think? We think too highly of ourselves. And he says there's something about viewing God that changes that. And that's true for everyone who's been born by the Spirit of God. For those who do not know God, there is no fear of God before their eyes. They will not change. But they'll never understand the greatness of God or the person of God. This is what James says. First of all, he says two things about God here. And perhaps if you don't view God very highly, the first thing he says won't be effective to you. But he says this, he giveth more grace, wherefore he saith, God resisteth the proud. The first thing he tells us about God is this, God resists the proud. That word resist means this. It means God sets himself in array against, or God sets himself in opposition against, or to put it another way, that's very appropriate for this word, God digs in for battle. Okay? It's pretty strong language. God resisteth doesn't mean God doesn't approve of, but turns his head away so that you can go on and do it. That's not what it is. When we think more highly of ourselves than we should, and we don't walk in humility before God, and by that we start chasing the friendship of the world, we start chasing our lustful desires, we start being filled with envy. When that happens, he says, God's not just saying, shaking his head saying, man, I wish you wouldn't do that. He said, God is digging in to do battle against you. God resists the proud. The first thing he says about God. Again, if there's no big view of God, though, so what? Right? Because if God is not a big opposition, if God is not a big foe, you know, most people, the only one with a gun, I'm not too scared of. I figure if they're smaller than me, I'll take them with my fists. If they're bigger than me, I'll outrun them, right? So there's no foe that's too scary to me. So if God is digging in, but he's not a big foe, so what, right? So again, it gets back to our perception, our view of God. What does it mean to say God digs in for battle against the proud. What does that mean? Who's God? Okay? And the next thing he says to us is this, humble yourselves. How do we do that? It's against nature. You know, stay out of the rain, or don't get wet in the rain. But it's not like that. Friends, we do become base. We do become humiliated, as Isaiah did, woe is me. We do come to the right view of self when we view God. Here's what he says, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord. And I think that passage can mean two things. Humble yourselves because God's always, you're always in God's sight. Okay? He's always there. The Latin phrase, coram Deo, is a powerful phrase in my life. I don't know, just grabs me. It means before the face of God. And that's the reality. We are always before the face of God. Always. Psalm 139. There is no place too low. There is no place too high. We're always before His face. But it also means this. Humble yourselves in the sight of God. In other words, look at God. Humble yourselves by looking at God. And that's really the key right there, friends. Humble yourselves. It's impossible to do unless we look at God. Unless we know who God is. Unless we really view God as He is. And so, let's just take a few minutes. I just want to spend a few minutes looking at God. Because this is the key. Oh, it's a miserable feeling to have a dry run when you're speaking about grace. It's miserable. What do I need to do? I need to get a bigger view of God. A smaller view of self. Why are you so miserable? So you didn't come out with your sermon the way you wanted to. So what? Were you talking about God? Were you opening up to the people's minds the reality that God is a God of grace? Were you showing them that grace cannot be earned, it cannot be merited? Were you doing that? Then why are you upset about it, right? We need to view God. Isaiah 40. You know, there's a million places we can go, but Isaiah 40 sure is good. So let's just go there. In fact, it's what he says to Zion. By the way, Isaiah comes to speak to people who have lost their view of God. Isaiah is a preacher to those who are in danger of pending judgment. In fact, eventually they were judged. They were taken into captivity. Many were slaughtered. They became slaves. Judah was no more until the return by God's sovereign grace. So he's speaking to people who have lost their view of God. And he comes in this chapter, as if he's been beating them over the head with it, which is good. Tell them the truth. He comes in this chapter and he says, comfort ye, my people, saith your God. Again, it's kind of like saying, if God's no foe, what is it? If no big foe, then so what if he's digging in for battle? If God's no big deal, so what if he says, comfort ye, what does it mean? Unless God is really something. So he says in verse 9, O Zion that bringeth good tidings, get thee up into the high mountain. O Jerusalem that bringeth good tidings, lift up thy voice with strength, lift it up, be not afraid. Say unto the cities of Judah, behold your God. He says, our great need is to view God, to see God. And he begins to tell us who God is. Now, as we read these verses, remember, Isaiah's intent and James's intent and our great need is to view God in relation to, or to view God in comparison to ourselves. Because the great problem is that we become lifted up in our own thinking. The whole reason that our hearts end up with bad words, with sinful actions, is because we think we are more than we should think we are. And so as we read this, don't just read this as looking at some figure out there, but read this while also keeping yourself in the background of this picture, okay? Let's read it. You know it as well as I do, but let's begin reading in verse 12. Who hath measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? Now, God is an incomprehensible, incomparable being, okay? But what he does here is he tries to assist us. He tries to give us just a little glimpse of this incomprehensible God. Just give us some sort of idea of where we stand in relation to God, okay? And so we think, okay, I'm going to march up here. I'm 5'9". let me see where I stand in relation to God. And maybe a guy that's 6'10" can say, or Goliath, I'm 9'6". Let me see where I stand in relation to God. And so we think, we'll walk up here as individuals and compare ourselves to God. That's not what He does. He does it later, but not right here. So as you see yourself in the background, just notice how far back in the background we are in relation to God. It doesn't start with the greatest king, Nebuchadnezzar, or the greatest conqueror, Alexander the Great, or the fiercest foe, Nero. It doesn't start there. They're not worthy of comparison yet. Here's where He starts. Who hath measured the waters in the hollow of His hand? Isn't that something? All the waters, the depths of the seas. He said, how do they compare to God? He said, well, God would hold them and He would measure them in this little bitty place, the hollow of His hand. That's a comparison of God to the waters, if you will. Have you been to the ocean, guys? Right? And the waves are kind of fun to go out there and play in, right? But there is a time the waves get to a certain point that you begin to get a little bit less comfortable, right? Like, oh, you know, maybe I'll get closer to the shore. Not sure I should go out right now. Or maybe you're swimming out there and it gets a little bit deeper and a little bit farther away. You get a little bit tireder. And you think, you know, I'm no match for this water here. I better go back towards shore, right? And then there are those times when the warnings come for days before and they say, everybody, get away. Get away as far as you can from the water. Go as far inland as you can, because it's going to become a hurricane with such force that it's going to blow away all the structures. And this water, you probably remember the tsunami that came to the eastern, to the east, the far east several years ago. Incredible video of these people running and these huge waves coming and just taking buses and cars and trains and buildings and just throwing them back into the sea. Unbelievable force. That's one hurricane. Or one tsunami in one little ocean. And God says, yeah, I got all that in the hollow of my hand. And all of it. And meted out heaven with a span. And comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure. And weighed the mountains in scales. Let's just see how much of this weigh. Isn't that an amazing picture? You have this little scale and you measure flour on it before you buy it, or you measure sugar on it or whatever, and you put the weight on one end and you put the sugar on there. And you go, yeah, it's about half a pound. I think it's about right. We'll take that home with us. And God says, I move mountains and I pick them up and I put them on the scales. And yeah, it weighs about, you know, 40 trillion pounds. And this is reality, friends. This is God. He's trying to give us understanding just the greatness of God. And the hills in a balance. Who hath directed the Spirit of the Lord, or being His counselor, hath taught Him? With whom took He counsel, and who instructed Him, and taught Him in the path of judgment, and taught Him knowledge, and showed to Him the way of understanding? I don't remember where this came from, it's came into my mind, but I read somewhere this week, I forgot who it was, maybe heard a conversation, that there was somebody, who was it? I don't know, it doesn't matter. I wish I knew. Maybe somebody told me this Sunday. If you do, raise your hand. Somebody has a friend who I believe, I wish I could remember this. Somebody has a friend who grew up a Christian. I know where I saw it now, never mind, on Facebook. Grew up a Christian. He went to school, got sucked into the whole evolutionary scheme and idea, became a wildlife biologist or maybe a botanist or something where he was outside all the time. He said just one day he was walking through the woods. He had been there as his job. He does it every day. It's become so familiar to him. And all of a sudden, the thought struck him. And he says, as I turn around and I looked, everywhere I see design. This is a system, he says. This is a man who has already been exposed to this and has debunked this in his own thinking and has considered this, rejected this in his own thing. He says, no. And he's bought into all the science and not just did it during a kind of a vulnerable year in college, but he devoted his life, his whole career, to living out the truth that there is no God through this evolutionary scheme. And he's walking through what he knows better than I know. He looks around and says, wait a minute, this is a system. There has to be a designer. This is design. He was brought back upon his knees to embrace and fall down before a sovereign God. That's beautiful, isn't it? Ask your friends, who gave God this knowledge and understanding and judgment to be able to design this world the way He did? Okay, now we're going to get a little bit closer to where we are. We've been in the, have had the waters in the hall of our hand. And then He says, behold the nations. Oh, friends, I don't know. I don't always know the right perspective. I don't always know the right balance. I know that. God says to be good citizens in the land that God's given us. And I don't want to pick on Facebook because I'm just as sinful as anybody. I just like to post about it. More prideful than that. But friends, if you were to follow Facebook, my friends anyway on Facebook, over the last 6 months or whatever, and you were to compare the statements about God to the raging concern over this election, it would kind of be like measuring these hills and the waters of the hall of our hand. I'm not saying it's all wrong. I'm not saying that at all. I don't know the proper balance. But I know it's way out of kilter. We're way worried and way concerned. We would forget that the nations are as a drop of a bucket in comparison to God. Now, it's an important drop of a bucket because God created it. And God put us here at this time in this place to live and to seek to live in godliness and quietness and honesty. And if we were to take this blessing of freedom that God's given us and just say we don't care about it at all, well, what would that be saying about the thankfulness for the blessing of God? It would say we don't care about the blessing of God, right? And so I'm not saying, please don't get me wrong, I'm not saying there shouldn't be concern, there shouldn't be prayer, there shouldn't be activity. But just remember this. The nations are as a drop of a bucket. And that's not just talking about the 2012 elections. That's talking about the nation that have always been and will always be in relation, in comparison to this great God. And are counted as a small dust of the balance, a drop of a bucket. Let me just do this. Let me just put this finger and just flick one drop out of this cup. And nobody rushes up with a towel, right? Because it's insignificant, right? If I don't wipe it away, I will. If I don't wipe it away, it'll dry. And it hopefully won't stain Brother Aaron's thing there. It'll be okay. It's just a drop out of a cup. But a drop of a bucket's a bigger deal, right? So, I mean, it's more distinct. That's not the right word. Smaller. In comparison. In Lebanon, listen to this. The cedars of Lebanon were the glory of Israel. I talked about this last year in a message on Isaiah 11. The cedars of Lebanon were the glory of Israel. The place this is the evidence of God's blessing and His glory. It's a place of great pride. He says, take all the cedars of Lebanon, and Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor the beast thereof sufficient for a burnt offering. How are you going to express? An offering was to express, we're not worthy. And you're greatly worthy of honor, right? That's what an offering did. There was thanks there and there was praise there. But it's all about saying you're worthy of a lot. You're worthy of devotion. You're worthy of honor. You're great. And He says, listen, with this God, all the cedars of Lebanon, go ahead and cut them down, stack them in a pile, pour some gasoline on it, and send up a great big huge sacrifice of burning to God. It's not sufficient for Him. He's too big. All nations before Him are nothing, and they counted Him as less than nothing and vanity. To whom then will you liken God, or what likeness will you compare to Him? The workman, people try, I think this effort, the workman melteth a graven image. And do you begin to see why God says, don't put any graven images here? Begin to understand why that? It's not because God just doesn't like beautiful things. It's that, listen, friends, God's too big. He's too glorious to be compared by some symbol, some attempt to make a likeness, to make something that is worthy of glorifying Him. And Brother Lewis said the only thing that glorifies God, the only worship, it must come in spirit. It must come in truth. It must come from the heart, right? Because that's the instrument God has created to bring forth glory to Him. The workman
graven image and the goldsmith, and maybe this workman had good intentions. Maybe they weren't attempting to, as the children of Israel did, to go worship a golden calf and reject God. Maybe they had good intentions here, but this still doesn't matter. The workman melted the graven image, and the goldsmith spread it over with gold and cast a silver change. He that is so impoverished that he hath no oblation, he has no chooseth of the tree that will not rot. He seeketh a cunning workman to prepare a graven image that shall not be moved. He says, have you not known? Have you not heard? Hath it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? Can you not look at the earth and just see this? There's no graven image. Look to the one who sits on the circle of the earth. Oh, friends, when I flew to India, it was just amazing to, first of all, to realize how fast we were going. You're flying at 500 and something miles an hour, I think it was. I forget what it was. And you're looking down, you're not looking down, but you're looking at the screen that shows you all the cities and the state, the countries you're passing. You're flying over Iraq. You're like, let's just go this way a little bit. You're flying over Afghanistan, I think. And we flew over Iran. And these are huge, huge things in our world today, right? Huge places of importance and attention. And we're just kind of flying over them as fast as you can go. And you're in this plane for hours and for hours and for hours. You can fly, I forget how many thousand miles. You think, man, I'm pretty small in comparison to this big earth. And God says, listen, I'm sitting on the circle of the earth. Look up here. And the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers. That's where we are. So you're 5'11"? Okay, come on up. Oh, you can bench press 300 pounds. That's great. Come on up. Oh, you have all the wisdom in the world. You know how to raise children, and you know how to do your job, and you're confident in everything you do. Okay, come on up. And I want you to stand here next to God. And the inhabitants of the earth, and friends, you say this for the present inhabitants, you say this for people of Ripley, you say this for the people that have ever lived, ever. The inhabitants of the earth are as grasshoppers. He stretcheth out the heavens as a curtain and spread them out as a tent to dwell in. He bringeth the princes to nothing. And there's a lot in that statement, isn't there? Oh, I love history because you can see things in the big picture. You see the beginning. You see the fatal flaw. You see the conclusion. You see the rise to power. You see the fall from power. It's fascinating to see. And there are story after story after story throughout history. All of history contains nothing but stories of rises and falls, ebbs and flows, power that seemed it seemed impenetrable, right? And you see it all come falling down flat. Every single civilization. Some that were built with good intentions and with great ideas and made great advances. And some that were barbaric and vile and evil and lascivious. And yet every single civilization rises and falls. And we just kind of read it as, he brings princes to nothing. You go back and look at the stories. And you look at the lives of the people who endured those things. And every night for many Christians must have seemed like, well, they pass away. They snuck into their little places to meet and worship. And the authorities come crashing in upon us. Well, they find us out and the many who escaped, but also the many who were found out. And they were taken to the prisons. And they were taken in Rome. And they were experiencing this cruel, awful, humiliating deaths, painful deaths. And those lives lived out. In moment by moment excruciation. And yet God says, I brought these princes to nothing. By the way, this great big God says, I will not forget the blood of a single martyr. That's both in the degree to which He raises them up and lifts them up. And it's also in the degree of punishment that He will come pouring down in wrath upon those who know not God. And hate the people of God. I know I'm way over time. Let me read this. He maketh the judges of the earth as vanity. You know, the decree of Nebuchadnezzar, right? About the falling down to the and before the music and the big golden structure. That seemed awful, didn't it? You think about those three Hebrew children. I love what they say. They say, listen, we know God's able. We know what we're going to do. But we can't bow down to this thing. And their situation seemed as dire as can be. This great judgment's come down. This great decree, this great rule has come down. And what are you going to do against a rule that's made by men in more powerful places than you? And he says, it's vanity. It's like the vapor just vanishes away. As it did on that day, didn't it? He could not make the fire any hotter. The men who threw them into the fire were burned to a crisp. What else is he going to do? They're standing in the fire and they're walking and they're talking. The oxygen should have way earlier left their bodies. They should have suffocated and burned. And God says, that judgment, it's like vapors. It means nothing. Well, listen. He says to us, verse 26, lift up your eyes on high and behold. This is the thing. Behold your God. Behold who hath created these things that bringeth out their host by number. He calleth them all by name by the greatness of his might, for that he is strong in power, not one faileth. Why sayest thou, O Jacob, and speakest, O Israel, my way is hid from the Lord, and my judgment is passed over from my God? There's two ways to look at this verse. One way to look at this verse is, and this is true, sometimes in our great distress, in our great despair, we think, God's not even watching me anymore. He doesn't know why I'm here. He's forgotten about me. He would say to us, are you kidding? When he could hold the waters in the hollow of his hand, you think he's got trouble keeping up with the people that he loves? That's the first way to look at this, okay? Second way is true as well. It's the whole thing about pride, right? Think of ourselves more highly than we should. And we say, here's what we say in effect. We say, my way is hid from the Lord. God doesn't know what I'm doing. More than that, God doesn't care. And more than that, I'll get away with it. He's not that big of a foe. That's pride, friends. And he says, are you ready to do that? You still want to come up and stand beside me and compare yourself? Grasshopper? He says, listen, hast thou not known, hast thou not heard that the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary. There is no searching of his understanding. And here's the promise. Here's the place, friends, where we begin again in a wonderful way to compare ourselves or to bring ourselves back into relation to God, seeing ourselves in the view of seeing God. Here's the truth of the matter is, he giveth power to the faint. And to help them that have no might, he increaseth strength. Now here's the opposite. You want to think of yourself more highly than you should? You want to walk in pride? Listen to this. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. The truth of the matter is, you can go on for a long time, but you're going to get weary. You can get really strong, but you're going to fall. When you're full of yourself, and God's kind of small, you can go for a while, but you're going to get weary. And you can build yourself up. You can ignore these things, but you're going to fall. On the opposite side, to those who see themselves low, but see God is big, he gives power to the faint. He increaseth the strength of them that have no might. And they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Friends, there's no greater need for me as your pastor. There's no greater need for you in your efforts to walk purely before God than to see God. See God. May God bless you.